We wouldn't be in the same position if you just started to talk about this.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, a bit late. Coffee machine was slow. Or something. And okay, any big questions on lithography or thin film deposition? Everything clear? Yes, it's a simple thing. It is, and you start doing it, and then you see all these practical difficulties, but then you just learn them, and then it's a simple thing. Okay. And okay, let's start other way around. Now we start removing material, not depositing it. So we have again our pattern made, and then we want to remove material from this open areas of our pattern. So etching. Removing material from a sample by physical or chemical methods. There's some old etched painting, so it is used also for art a lot. Yeah, usually substrate is protected by pattern mask, and then your mask is stripped off or removed at the edge. There's actually lots of different variations, but basically you can categorize this in two categories: wet etching and dry etching. Dry etching is usually also called plasma etching, because usually it needs plasma. But usually, always. Actually not always. There's a couple of things that you can do it without plasma also. And wet etching means that you have a solid which you want to etch and you put liquid. So for example, you want to etch your silicon. And you put some hydrogen ions in one way or other. One very common is use of potassium hydroxide, KOH, K-O-H, which is actually the same they sell in shops to open your pipes if your sewer is stuck. Same stuff. You put that inside the water. And what it makes is silicon hydroxide, oxygen, whatever is this called. And since it has a charge, it's a solution, soluble to the water. So you can basically make a silicon hydrogen compound, which is taken away by water. And then you produce hydrogen as a gas, so that's why your etching chamber is boiling. So it's making bubbles of hydrogen. So this is how it is. Etch the silicon away. In a plasma or dry etching, for example, if you want to etch silicon oxide in this case, as an example, so that's a solid, and then you take a carbon fluoride as a gas, and what you get out is a silicon fluoride as a gas and carbon dioxide as a gas, of course. And of course here the important thing is that silicon fluoride bond forms more easily than silicon oxide bond. So that's why you are replacing silicon oxide with silicon fluoride. And you are putting energy for that reaction to happen. In a wet etching, you can control temperature. Here also you can control temperature, or you can use plasma, which is actually more common. And what you need to take care of is that your byproduct, which you want to take away, is here in a gas format and here in a soluble to water. since if this is a solid format, then you're actually not etching anything. You are just replacing silicon dioxide with silicon fluoride, and just keeping the same. And when you use plasma, it's called reactive ion etching. So this is the most common one of many dry etching methods. And usually it's used for solids, it's by chemical reaction using gases. So this is kind of a opposite CVD. In chemical vapor deposition, we had a precursors which react on the surface, and they react on the surface by the energy of a plasma, like here, or just heating. But this is actually exactly opposite for plasma enhanced CVD. And now here you basically take the same precursor. It's actually not called precursor here, it's called the etching gas. Same idea, different name. And what you make is again this kind of excited species radicals which react easily. For example, this if you put this carbon fluoride, the fluoride is actually ripped off from a carbon in the plasma very easily. And then these fluoride ions are accelerated to your substrate and they are actually hitting open areas and very easily reacting. Also, they are sputtering your substrate away. So you can tune actually this process so that you have a chemical reaction and it's really selective. So you are only reacting to certain materials, or you can take all the chemistry away, just put argon in and start hitting by ions and just hammering stuff off, like a sputtering. And you can have everything this way. Little bit chemical reaction with a lot of sputtering, or little bit sputtering in a top of a chemical reaction. And that's why, since you have this kind of hammering, ion bombardment is a correct word for that hammering. So ion bombardment, then basically you can easily etch just downwards, not in a side way. In a chemical case, the chemical reaction happens in all the directions. So that's why you can tune your isotropic profile. Next slide actually supports that. And there's some example, actually this is the same example. So you have now it's a silicon. Yeah, you can also get silicon with the same gas, but now you need oxygen because you don't have a silicon dioxide. So you need oxygen also. So this is very common way and lots of use. So what is mean actually isotropic etching and anisotropic etching? This is important terms. Isotropic means that it goes same speed every direction. So for example, you have this structure. So you have your substrate. Then you have your resist with a certain hole. And then you start etching. So you can think every point here, start etching all the directions. So you make these kind of circles. So you're etching as much this direction as in this direction. This pen writes in a different position than I point. Annoying. That's why the bad drawing. But so basically you can, every open dot in your surface is kind of a circular point where you start etching every direction. That's why you generate this kind of a huge so-called undercuts. Because here it starts to etch downwards, and here same speed. Okay, if you want narrow lines, you have made really nice lithography with a 20 nanometer opening. Then you start etching and you have to etch 50 nanometer. You are also etching 50 nanometer on a sideways. So your 20 nanometer opening produces 120 nanometer line. This is usually not what you want. That's why you need anisotropic etching. And this now a little bit depends. If we talk dry etching, like reactive ion etching, then it means exactly what I mentioned in the previous slide, that you etch downwards faster than the sideways, and you can get vertical walls. Then you get your 20 nanometer line. But in the wet etching, it doesn't work like that. There's nothing to kind of making it to etch vertical more. And since it's purely chemical process, it actually depends on a crystalline plate of your structure. So most commonly, silicon wafers are so-called 100 oriented crystal structure. If you want to find out what is this exactly mean, you can check any material physics book. So it means that your crystal structure is in a certain orientation. And what happens there, then this 111 plane, which is kind of the most dense plane in your crystal structure. So that kind of stops the etching. And in this case, they are oriented 54.7 degree angle. And this is always what you get if you etch with a hydroxyl ions, for example, this potassium hydroxide. It always produces this kind of shape. Even you have this kind of opening, it will stop here and here, and here it can proceed, and then it ends. This is not full stop. It can also edge in this direction, but really slow. And for example, if you have this kind of mask here, you always get this exactly the same angle lines. If you want vertical walls, then you can order special oriented silicon. So where this 111 are vertical one. Then you can get nicely vertical. But that's more expensive. Okay. This is the most common oriented silicon. And this is one of the standard shapes which I used routinely. You can take advantage of that if you know how it works. So in anisotropic etching, dry etching and wet etching, it means different things. But in both cases, it's not isotropic. Okay. So if you start thinking of this, so basically that was kind of all of this top-down lithography. Now we took a little bit too early that break. This would have been better place. But, I thought there was a little bit more about etching, but it's so simple. You just take a strong solvent and etch your things. Are these all really needed? This kind of structures. So there's a microfabrication steps. So microchip meaning processor or any integrated server or something. But what you need, these are not in order. Some are repeated many times during the process, some not. So wafer cleaning, that's always needed in many, between every steps basically. Solvents such as acetone, as I mentioned. Piranha is used a lot. So it's sulfur acid and hydrogen peroxide mixed. You know that these react all very heavily. So if you mix them, it starts boiling immediately and heating, and then you start throw your chips before it stops boiling. It leaves it very efficiently. And then there's this kind of standard RCA clean. You can find many recipes if you Google that. It has several steps. Removing all organic compounds with a certain solvent, removing this kind of silicon dust by certain compounds and so on. What is actually also used a lot is that you oxidize your silicon, then you etch silicon oxide away. And silicon oxide is easily etched by hydrofluoric acid, HF. And then you form a clean oxide. So basically you remove the oxide and all the dust particles on top of that. So this is used also. Then you do your lithography, photolithography. If you do doping for semiconductor, then you have ion implant, implanting. Ion implanting means that you have basically ion beam coming and open areas the ions are going inside the silicon, which are covered by the resist, then the ions are stopping in a resist. So usually you have to have a thick enough resist. Then you can do etching. Resist removal. One way to remove resist is actually plasma. Just burn it away. Oxygen plasma is very good for that. It's also very good for cleaning. Every organ is burned away immediately. Thermal treatments, annealing, for example, if you do ion implantation, your ions are in a certain depth, then you do annealing and they diffuse around and then you can make a as wide profile as you want. Then you have a chemical vapor deposition, physical vapor deposition, molecular beam epitaxy, electrochemical deposition, which I mentioned at the beginning by this electroplating. And between all the layers, you have this kind of chemical mechanical polishing. Here is a planarization. Okay, I don't know which, I think usually it's called polishing, which means that you remove extra, so you make it really flat again. Which is, means that you take some slurry and then you put some sanding and you start polishing. But it has to be really not any sandpaper, but really this kind of smooth slurry. And then you do all these thousands of times and then you get your chip. This is one reason for industry to use a photolithography, because you need so many steps. You want to make it for billions of chips at the same time. And by photolithography, you can do it. You can have a huge wafer and do it for full wafer, and only at the end you cut, separate these devices. Okay. But we have a bottom-up methods also. So this was discussed all already in Kaiser's lecture. So far there was top-down fabrication, and now we start from bottom to up. What you taught in the Kaiser's lectures mostly, I think, is chemical synthesis. And a little bit self-assemble also, we discussed already, but we go a little bit more on that. And then is one more big thing, atom by atom. Then you move really atom by atom. For example, scanning probe microscope. And this is kind of where this all meets in a nanoscale. So in a physics, it has always been that you make top-down fabrication, especially in this kind of electronics and industry. Not in all physics, but basically it is mostly that. You want to make it smaller and smaller. In a chemistry, you want to start with molecules are usually much smaller than a nanometer or about a nanometer, but then you want to make a supermolecules and bigger molecules and you end up till tens of nanometers or hundreds of nanometers, which is exactly where you have also reached from a top down. And then basically you realize after that that all the biological components in molecular biology are already in that state. So nature has invented that that is a good scale already billions of years ago. So we are coming a bit late. So this is atomic manipulation by STM scanning tip, scanning tunneling microscope. So this was one of the first, it was already 80s, very end of 80s. So you organize your molecules on the surface by just kicking them with your time tip. We will discuss scanning probe microscopy at the end of this lecture. So I don't start to exactly now explain how you do it, but you just do it. And for example, here are these xenon atoms organized to this logo of this IBM company who made it. But then there's a metal atoms organized on a ring on a metallic surface. You see these nice wave patterns. What is that? Any idea? Are you making some scratches to your surface or? Does anyone have an idea? Also Zoom, online people can answer. Oh, it was some metal. Now I don't, actually I have it in a later slide. It was metallic atoms on the same metal surface. That's all you need to know basically. What?
Magnetic effect?
Yeah. But no, it's not a magnetic metal, no. But electrical effect. That's much more easier. And what is actually, it's kind of electrical effect, and what you actually see is a wave function of an electron. So it's a quantum mechanism. You can actually image the wave function. So this is your probability to have electrons at that position. And it's interfering. Since you have a circular structure, you have a circular interference and you get an interference pattern. We come to scanning tunneling microscope. I have an explanation how it works, but basically it measures exactly how easily electron goes through from tip to substrate. And if you have a higher probability to have electron at this position, then the current goes more easily. And if you don't have electrons at that position on your substrate, the current doesn't go. So that's why you can actually image. You can image wave function, you can even image molecular orbitals, as we see later, which are wave functions also. Okay, chemical synthesis, I don't think I will not talk anything about that. Guys already talked that enough. So you know what is chemical synthesis, so you use the point different than from a self-assemble is that you use covalent bonds. And these are kind of hard and permanent materials that you produce. But self-assemble, there you use a weak bonds, and the simple self-assemble would be self-assembled monolayers. I don't think this was not in a Kaisa's lecture. She had some other examples of a self-assemble. But this is kind of exactly what interests, for example, in this combination of top-down fabrication. So you have some substrate, and you want to monolayer of a material. So you can take this kind of tile. What is a tile? It's just a sulfur SH ending. And then if you put it to the next to the cold film, this hydrogen will go away and you make a sulfur gold bond, which is covalent bond. This is very known technique and lot of used. So it's just called tile. And then you have this tile group at the end of organic tail. So you have some hydrocarbon, whatever. It can be different things. Here's, for example, some examples. And you can functionalize the other end also if you want. But if you don't functionalize, what happens? Because this tile, they want to bond to the gold because this is energetically the minimum. Always systems are driven to minimum energy. So you basically cover the whole gold surface with the tile groups. And of course, the organic tails are sticking out. And of course, next layer coming here, they don't attach anymore because this organic tail is covering the gold. You get very good coverage and only single layer of molecules. That's why self-assembled monolayer. When then one, which is, these are a little bit on the borderline, would I call it bottom up or not? But it's usually categorized on the bottom up. So that's why it's here. It's a special type of chemical vapor deposits. So it's atomic layer deposits. And this is, I have to always mention that is actually invented in Finland in the 70s. So this Finnish invention. So you basically, okay, it's all written here, but it's much more easy to explain on the next slide. You can read it later. So basically what you do cycles. So you put, you have these precursors, like in a chemical vapor deposition, but they are a little bit specially selected so that you actually make this self-assembled monolayer by that. So you don't start building up and you don't react. You just put one chemical, zinc chloride, for example, in this example case. It's like this kind of Mickey Mouse looking molecule, and it attaches from a zinc to your substrate and covers it, and the next layer does not attach because the chloride is preventing it. So you have to be a little bit clever and choosing your precursors so that you get a monolayer. If you don't get a monolayer, it's a CVD and that's it. It's not atomic layer deposition. But in this case, you have selected it clever, so it adapts only as a monolayer. After that, you keep it for a while for it to adapt every place. It also nicely goes behind the corners and small holes so it can cover everywhere. Then you purge. Usually you put hydrogen. Yeah, hydrogen. Hydrogen in to flush away rest of the zinc chloride. And you only left with the one which is attached to the substrate. Then you put the next gas which reacts with the zinc chloride. And in this case, it's a hydrogen sulfide. H2S, and that reacts with a zinc chloride on the surface, and you make a zinc sulfide layer. And this was what you wanted. And again, at the byproduct is a HCl, so strong acid, and what you then do is you purge away that by nitrogen again. Then you have only single atomic layer of a zinc sulfide. That's why the name. But then you start all over, next layer, and all the steps. And then you have two layers, and so on. So you can really precisely control how many layers you want and what is the thickness. That's why the atomic layer deposition name. So you may really make atomic layers. And thickness control is easy. You just repeat as much as you want the layers. Okay, not the most fastest method. In a CVD, you just put all the gases in and they just react and that's it. And you can grow easily thick layers. But these thick layers is a problem. It takes a lot of time. But you can be very precise. You can easily make this kind of nanolaminates. So you have different materials because you just pitch in the next cycle, you just put a different precursor and to take a different sequence of cycles. And then you test back. And you can make this kind of graded structure so it material changes gradually from something to some other material. Or you can make really fancy compounds. So basically, this way you can make new materials. You don't need to discover it anymore. You can just make exactly what you want. Yeah, doping was one. So you can put some, for example, aluminium oxide in a certain distance. So you have a certain amount of aluminium doping. And the biggest usage of ALD nowadays is exactly this gate oxide, what I mentioned. This hafnium oxide. You cannot make it by any other method. You have to use atomic layer deposition and you want it to precise thickness. So here is, for example, transmission electron microscope image. So there's a silicon and then you have a hafnium oxide layer here. There's certain interface layer, which means that the hafnium oxide crystalline structure is not matching to the silicon and you have a little bit amorphous stuff in between. But then you have a hafnium oxide nicely here. And this is 37 angstroms, so 3.7 nanometers. Pretty thin. And then you have your metal gauge or whatever is that material in this case. So this is where the ALD is used most. Another thing where it is used is optical filters, because you can make really precise interference effects. So you can make really precise, for example, this kind of filter which only lets through from one micron 574 nanometer is the exact limit. Something like that, till one micron 590. So really tiny region of wavelengths, what is passing through, and everything else is filtered out. This can be made very precise, but this is, for example, is something like a 45 microns thick and it's 200 layers of different materials. So it is a little bit designer how the interference goes and also fabrication. Okay, in the nature, self-assembly is using, or nature is using self-assembly a lot, let's put it this way. For example, DNA, protein folding. Did you discuss anything about protein folding with Kaisa? Probably not. You will. You will get it later. Viral assembly, viruses, and so on. And this is a point, important point, why the self-assembly in the nature. Because in many processes, you change your protein or DNA or something to a different form. For example, DNA, when you are copying it, you have to break the self-assembled structure, copy it, and then put it back again. If it would be made from a covalent bond, it would require a huge amount of energy. Nothing would work. Everything would be really slow. So that's why exactly these weak bonds are really important in the nature and self-assemble. And also, they are coded by this method. And if there happens any mistakes, which easily happens also in the nature, they can be easily corrected. There's a huge amount of error correction happening on the nature all the time. And when there is error correction doesn't happen, then some nasty things happen, like cancer, Alzheimer, Parkinson. All this is due to misfolding because the error correction has been failed. So it's really important decision by the nature. Probably nature has tried also covalent things, but they have just died out. You never know. But this is kind of the key point there. And I a little bit wanted to talk about DNA nanotechnology, which is now, of course, I'm doing it myself, so I'm really interested in that and have a knowledge about that. It's a nice example also. It's just not just purely selfish reasons, but also for that. But selective, because it's really getting wider and wider, very popular method nowadays. And it nicely combines between the different disciplines. You can use it for top-down, and together with top-down, even it's a bottom-up itself. All you know, DNA, it's like that. Spiral structure, which where you have a basis, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine, or ATCD, more easily. And it's only making pairs, A to T and C to G. And this is what makes it possible that you can recognize one sequence in a one strand to a sequence in another strand. And this you can use for self-assemble. So here's a full chemical structure. So you have a sugar phosphate backbone here, and then you have a base sticking in and pairing with the other in other strand. And why it is actually handy molecule is that you can nowadays there's a for other reasons, for bio research and for medical research, there's a lot of ways how you can produce DNA and how you can read out the sequences. Because this DNA sequencing is used to detect many things. Okay, of course, our identity can be detected, but also you can do tests for certain diseases and so on. So there's a lot of, you can isolate it very easily. Sometimes in a researcher's night, we have had even people have isolated DNA from a tomato by themselves. You can do it pretty easily. Also, you can do it by chemical synthesis, short oligos. So these are called oligonucleotides, which is exactly just a short strand of DNA, nothing else. You can do it by chemical synthesis, up to 100 bases. You can do longer, but the yield goes down. And this means the cost goes up and nobody wants to do it. Polymer chain reaction, this is very common method. So you start amplifying your DNA. You use the same method when the cell divides. When you copy, it copies the DNA and builds a new one. You basically use the same reactions, but then you put some DNA to copy And then you cycle your termary up and down, and every cycle you build a new DNA. So if you had a one first, then a second cycle you have two, then next cycle you have four, then eight, so it grows exponentially. So you get a lot of DNA easily. Yeah, not much DNA started, needed to start. So many of these are tests, actually. That's why it takes a day or two, is that you run the PCR. You amplify your sample and see what you had here. Okay. This Ned, the dude who invented the whole DNA self-assembled thing. And this was the first idea how you can use it. So you have regular DNA, and you know that it makes this kind of spiral helical structure. You cannot use that for not much or anything. But if you do it more clever way, so that, okay, these are just simplified view from a DNA, so I don't draw it helical because it goes a little bit difficult to draw. So you have these two strands here and the bases between, or base pairs. Now you take this red strand here so that it forms a basis to this blue one in this region. But this region, it doesn't anymore form bases. So the bases don't match anymore. What is this pen doing? Now it's okay. Okay, not so handy as I thought. So here it doesn't form anymore bases with a blue one, but actually you can find a complementary basis from a orange one. So it makes a base pair with orange strand here. And orange strand and this part don't anymore make base pair with a red one, but actually you find a complementary sequence on a green one. And you make a base pair here. So you have in these regions, you have a base pairs always between the structures. And you can only make this kind of structure to have every basis paired. So you can have this kind of branching DNA. So you have four branches. I think they have made up to 8 or 12 branches. And this is called holiday junction because it's exactly the same kind of junction when you, again, when your cells are dividing, you copy the DNA, Gerrit will tell you more details of this. And during the copying, you have exactly that structure. Except in that case, because it's copying the same DNA, it can move along the DNA. Here, it's made not movable. So this is exactly the only place where it can form. And here you have so-called sticky end. So these bases have not found a pair. So they are just hanging around there. But this can actually pair in here. Okay, but it cannot bend. It's a DNA, there's a certain radius it can bend. So it doesn't bend and make this kind of knot by itself, but since you have millions of these in a solution, you take the next one and pair with that, and you make this kind of grid. Yeah, so this is more like a helical form of that. So here is actually made, this is one of the first 91, where you have made this kind of cube. You have this kind of three branches in every corner. It was nice structure, but it was totally floppy. Never was a cube. That's why the title was synthesis of DNA molecule with a connectivity of a cube. They didn't claim it to be a cube because it never was. But similar, if you would keep it still, then you have also saying octahedron was made, but then people wanted something more rigid, and they made this kind of triple crossover molecules, where you have all these strands. So here you have a blue strand pairing with a green one, but then suddenly the green one comes to the middle, and then it pairs to itself, and here to the purple one, and then it comes again, pairs with a purple one, and with a red one. And this is the only way it can organize itself to have all bases paired. And as I said, the system wants to go to minimum energy. A minimum energy for the single DNA strand is to have all bases paired. And basically the same happens for all other strands. And there's exactly these sums what kind of knits it together. Because here you cannot separate these two helices because they are connected by these tracks here. Also here. That's why it keeps together, and then there's a three helical strand. So this is how it actually looks in a 3D model. And if you look from a side, it's a three helices. This is much more rigid already. It doesn't bend so much. By that, you can make, for example, this kind of lattices. So there's atomic force microscope image of this kind of lattices. So this is 1.5 micron, about. You can have a really big structures, and these are all DNA. And you can even connect some nanoparticles to some of the types to make an array of nanoparticles. And here, this kind of Tetris things that this matches to that means that you have a sticky end with matching base pairs or matching cases, sorry. Exactly the same idea as in the original one. Okay, this millennium, there was something even better invented, so-called DNA origami. So the name comes from that you don't fold your paper as in a Japanese origami, but you fold your DNA. And then you can fabricate whatever shapes, basically. With a high yield. Here, the yield was problem because you have a similar sort oligonucleotides, and you have had to exactly correct amounts then to organize that. It's a little bit tedious, like a chemical synthesis, that you need to take care of your surroundings and with temperature and so on. But in origami, basically you just throw in the things and that's it. The idea is different. It uses similar crossovers. They are everywhere. Here, 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 and so on. But you have one long strand which is folded to the shape you want. Of course, you don't fold it, but it's folded because it's connected by these double strands. It's a stapling into this form. So these are the sort oligonucleotides which are forming a base pairs here, for example, but then not anymore here, but they are forming base pairs to this other place of the same so-called scaffold strand. And this is again the only way it can be formed, to have all the bases paired. And when you fabricate this, you have certain amount of scaffold strands. But then you have like a 10 times more of these staple strands, these short ones. And when you throw it in, you basically put it in a PCR machine, which every biolab has. You heat it to 90 degrees so that everything detaches. Then you slowly start to cool it down. And usually this takes some 10 hours or something like that, slowly. And during this time, all these staple strands will find a place. And you, all your scaffold strands, these long ones, have formed single origami. The yield is 99.9. So all the scaffold strands have formed an origami. But then, of course, you have to take all the rest of the staple strands away, because you had 10 times more of them. So your solution has still a lot of them, but this is easy, for example, filtering, because they are really tiny. The origami is 100 nanometers by 100 nanometers. You can easily use any centrifuge filter, or you can use gel electrophoresis, which is used in DNA research a lot. Any kind of purification method. And then you get rid of the rest of the staples. Basically, any of these staples can have a sticky end at the end. So you can have a, let's see if this drawing works. So you have your scaffold going here. This is long, it continues here and makes some shapes. This is just some place. And then you have your staples connecting it. So you have a base pairing happening in these places. But you can just extend your staple. It doesn't matter anything for this, making this origami. If this is a little bit longer and sticks out, and you have some extra bases here where you can connect next DNA with complementary bases, and then here you might have a tile, and then you might have a, for example, gold nanoparticle. Of course, your gold nanoparticle is fully covered by this DNA, but it is only this one to attach here. Actually, these three, that's tested. One is not enough. But then you take another one here. And you, now it has already two. So you can put these nanoparticles or whatever components to the position you want. Spacing of a staple strand is about 6 nanometers. So that's your design parameter. You can do any shapes within a 6 nanometer precision. So here is for one example. They attach this kind of origami, then they put a biotin at the end of this sticky end. And biotin binds to the streptavidin, which you might know. If not, now you know. It makes a very strong biological bonding. And streptavidin is something like 5 nanometer. So you put streptavidin there, and then you go to AFM, atomic force microscope, and what you see is your origami here, and then you have this streptavidin is connected. And they made some thiol-thiol bonding also between. And used some chemical to cleave it. They can remove some of these biotins. So these two are on the side are removed. And then they image and see that, yes, it works. So you can make a chemical reaction on the top of a origami. You can basically do some series also that you start reaction here, which then launches the reaction on the second place and so on, so that it proceeds in a certain path. You can make cube out of it. So this is a origami, so that these organize when you fold it, the origami, it will make a cube. It actually has a key, so it has a lock. So this has a one strand sticking out from a bottom part, and then you have one complementary strand sticking out from a lid. And they may make a base pair here in between, and it keeps the lid closed. But if you see the picture a little bit more carefully, you can see this, that this one strand is longer, a little bit. So it has a couple of bases unpaired. So it's a bit unhappy because it doesn't go to the minimum energy. So if you put a key strand, which is exactly complementary to this in a whole way, what happens is that this key goes in here and it replaces the original strand because it can form more bit bases. And the lid opens. And you can do it back and forth. Because of course this key actually in this picture is not, but actually you can make that even a little bit longer and then put complementary to that. And then it reduces the key and then it closes again. And they have used this called fret pair. So there's a fluorescence from this part, unless it's close to this other part, which takes all the energy and it doesn't fluoresce, so called quencher.
What's the scale? So small that I can barely see.
Ah, yeah, yeah, 78 nanometer is this.
Okay.
The dimensions of most of the origami is 100 nanometer or less, 78. Here, of course, it's smaller because you have used, because most of this scaffold strands, so it's a this long strand is a scaffold strand, and it's 13 something. It's taken from some bacteriophage. It's biological one. And it has around 7,000 bases. Oops. This is A. Not buses, but the bases. So that kind of limits the size. Nowadays, people have fabricated longer ones also. But this was the original because it was easily available because in a bacteriophage, it's already in a single strand form. You just steal it from there and use it. Okay, so that box was really leaky. It only had a helices, next helices, and there was some nanometer gaps. So idea would be, of course, that you put some medicine, like a cancer poison, it kills the cells, and it only opens when it detects keys, which can be programmed so that it's some DNA sequence usually appearing in the cancer cells. That it basically keeps your poison locked until it meets a cancer cell and then it opens. Nice idea, but it leaks really like it's not keeping anything in. So there has been some better designs with a multi-layer helices, which keep it much better. This is, for example, responding to pH in this case, and it's opening. And I already mentioned multilayer. So this was this single origami structure. And if you look at the helices as a tubes, they are like that. Next to each other connected by these crossovers. You can also fold it to this kind of structure and make here also the crossovers. Also here. Then you have a 3D structure. So you don't need to be working only in a one-dimensional single helistic DNA, but you can make it 3D. And there's some first examples. So this is like a brick. And this is 50. A bit of that's visible, yeah. And here's a couple of first ones made. Yeah, monolith, basically brick, and then in this kind of bottle. And nowadays, from this bottle size, they have actually made an injection. So this origami makes a nanopore to the cell, and you can inject drugs through that. And it even has a lid which opens by a key. And slotted across this kind of game, as you know. So this is, you can actually design these structures by computer. There's a program made to calculate it automatically, at least partly. And this is the whole design. So there's some couple of hundred of these stable strands. And maybe I stop here, then this is actually done here. So we have combined origami with the top-down method. And we can actually cover the whole surface of a DNA origami a certain shape, and then we can transform these to the metallic structures, for example, by using this, making a mask by using this DNA origami. So we are avoiding any photolithography, e-beam lithography. We are using origami to make the pattern. So our resolution is something like 6 nanometer. It is really much better than electron beam lithography, and we can cover the whole surface. Doesn't take that big or more. So here's, for example, this kind of bow tie antennas. Yes, then there was still nanoparticles. I didn't have much of these. So summary of a nanofabrication you can read here. I think the slide is up. So it looks like I didn't talk about scanning probe microscope today as planned. So I will continue that on the next. That was kind of expected. I was just kind of hoping that maybe this year I can get already to that. But no, it didn't happen. So we will start that for the next time. Questions?
Can you do that similar?